What I'm going to do in this session is look at the theme of vocation and worldview. Well, that's really two themes that are fused together for this session, for the sake of sort of getting through a lot of ideas in one go. And the goal I've got is to try and help us to think biblically about our responsibility as servants of God in any sphere where we find ourselves, not just professionally, but any area where we're working, where we're serving. But then to deliberately apply that a little bit to our role if we're teachers. But then also, I want to look at the subject of worldview, because one of the things that we have to come to terms with is the fact that God's truth is final, is presented to us as public truth that doesn't sort of belong amongst many various options in the world of ideas, but presents itself as God's final revelation and authoritative in terms of how we should live our lives and ultimately how the universe works and how it is best operated in. And what we as believers need to do is learn to see, first of all, our calling to serve God, not just in the context of religious life, as it were, but in the context of all of life, in other words, vocation, but also to think through what it actually means to do that. What would a Christian life look like as opposed to a non-Christian life in the world of teaching? The burden that's driven us toward this project of having these various days, amongst which this is the first, so you guys are the guinea pigs, and you guys are privileged, that's the best way to see it, is that the burden that's driven us is a sense that we certainly need to help Christians to see their Christian life as something that takes place well beyond a Christian meeting and well beyond even the community of church life, but it's something that they carry out right there, where they're serving, where they're employed, where they do their 9 to 5, or in your case probably 7 to 12, quite a lot of the time. And that's a huge theme. But also a theme that drives us is the fact that a person can believe that. A person can believe, yeah, okay, I'm not just a Christian, not just a teacher, I'm a Christian teacher. And I'm not just a Christian, but I'm a Christian teacher. That you're thinking, oh, I really do want to join these things together. I want to serve God there. But then may actually not realize that one of the primary ways we do that is by taking a biblical understanding of the world and of our job and applying it to our working life. We can pretend that we're being Christian teachers, nurses, doctors, solicitors, accountants, whatever, any kind of work, profession, any kind of craft, simply because we have, I don't know, maybe we have a fish on our lapel, or, you know, we have a Christian verse on our desk every day when we take off the calendar thing, or we just don't swear. Or even that we tell people about Jesus at coffee break and we pray hard for our colleagues to become Christians. Now, all of those things are good, apart from the fish on the lapel. That's abominable. But but all those things are valid and should be, you know, lauded as, you know, that's good. But the ironic thing is that those things in themselves are not actually what it means to serve God through your job. There's more to it than that. There's the application of a Christian worldview, which is what we'll be coming to in just a moment. Did I say lapel just now? I should say lapel, shouldn't I? I've been told off for that recently by someone else. I just realized it. Lapel. I'm so unsophisticated. So let's look first at this concept of vocation. Vocation. In the Bible, God is presented to us from the very beginning as a worker. God works. God stops working on the seventh day of creation, and that is marked as worthy of note. You know, God rested on the seventh day. So the first 6 days he wasn't resting, he was doing stuff. He was deliberately getting his hands dirty, so to speak, rolling up his sleeves, getting tasks accomplished. And that in itself is potentially a revolutionary concept, that God is a worker. And you may want to just sort of reflect on that, come to terms with it, that God's not merely passive and sort of in a place of sort of total apathy and it's just sort of an ethereal object that doesn't have any motion. God is in deliberate process of activity, doing things, and then creates a being after his own likeness, creates many, many, many beings, but then creates a being after his own likeness. And you get to one of the key verses of the whole story of God's plan through history is Genesis 1:28, where God creates man in his image, in his likeness, and then begins to give the man and the woman together this particular mandate to subdue the earth, to run the earth, to steward the earth on his behalf. And so the man and the woman are created with a responsibility, having been made in the image of a God who is practical, who does things, who is forming the earth out of chaos and out of a condition of formlessness. He's formed a world which actually has order to it. It resembles some kind of plan. And he's put a man and a woman in a garden and said, I want you to tend this garden. I want you to subdue it. Now, the idea of them being made in God's image carries huge freight, and we could spend a long time unpacking the idea of the Imago Dei, the image of God in man. And so many things we could say. One of the things, obviously, that we have to say is that we are called to represent God. That when man is seen in action, what is seen is something of the glory of God. Something of God's nature is on display as man does what man was made to do. There's an Old Testament scholar called Alec Mattia who I find so helpful. He's a very old man now and has written some amazing commentaries, but he makes the point that in ancient cultures, one of the things that often happened was rulers would set up statues of themselves on the frontiers of their territory. If a conqueror was very successful, he would want to establish the fact that he had dominion in a certain place. And the way that he marked that out, the way he visibly demonstrated that, was by having sculptors chisel out his image and put it on display in a place, and then sort of perhaps there would be an inscription saying, this ruler rules here. And really that was a way of intimidating any who would come. Saying, look, if you come beyond this frontier, you're in the territory of this ruler. Now, that concept, that idea, you could say it was kind of stolen from Genesis chapter 1. It's humans stealing God's idea. What God did in putting the man and the woman in the garden and saying, you are my image bearers, you carry my likeness, it's rather like God putting up on the frontiers of his creation some beings who represent him well and visibly show this is what God is like. And if you come here, you're in the domain of the God who this statue resembles. Only in our case, we're not statues. We are, we're organic. We're living beings. We have this life, this breath of life that God's put into us, and so we carry this extraordinary responsibility and privilege and dignity as those who bear His image, and we have this chance to steward His creation on His behalf. Certainly not on our own behalf, certainly not for our own glory, but nevertheless, huge responsibility to rule, to reign. as an extension of God's creation project. It's almost as though God put Adam and Eve in the garden, having spent 6 days creating, forming, establishing, ordering. It's as though he hands the job over. The work of creation somewhat sort of continues through the hands of this man and this woman. That's a very powerful idea of what work means. It actually ought to change the way we consider the jobs that we do. That as God's image bearers, we get to carry on this project that God began, put in motion when he said, "Let there be light." We actually live in the momentum of that, fulfilling that ongoing process. And so that instinct within us to create, to leave a mark, to shape the culture around us, is not necessarily a sinful thing in itself. The desire that you and I have, and in many people through history, it's an extraordinary desire, an extraordinary longing, a willingness to leave a mark, to do something great, to leave something behind, to create, to establish. That in itself is not sinful per se. In fact, it comes from the instinct that comes there by virtue of creation. God made us to do that, to represent him like that, to reflect him. Now, nevertheless, that nature in us has been terribly corrupted by the fall. But we have to just establish this. This is pre-fall, this idea of work as an act of bearing God's image and glorifying God, doing things to the honor of the one we represent, so that when people see what we do, God is glorified. When they see the way the garden is kept, if you like, God gets a lot of attention and a lot of praise, which means that our work takes on the proportions of worship. In fact, work and worship in the Hebrew idiom are hardly different. It's almost the same concept, that we worship God through the way that we serve him. We worship him with our labor all the time, not only in what we've just spent the last half an hour doing, but what we spend the next 7 times 24 hours doing, that we're constantly giving ourselves to worship in that way. And that which is being constructed was on behalf of God, for the glory of God, and reliant, therefore, on the resources and the strength of God. Not according to any strength that we have in ourselves innately that we hold back from him, but strength that is constantly, we need his help. We look to him for the supply. And in that sense, our umbilical cord with God is not ever to be severed. We're looking to him for the strength to serve, to create, to work. But with the fall, with what happened in Genesis 3, with our deliberate decision to set ourselves up effectively as judges, to take from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, to say, well, basically, we will be God. And remember, that was a temptation that the serpent brought to Adam and Eve in the garden. You will be as gods. It was as though that was the kind of clincher that won the deal in the argument in the garden. We can't do that. God told us not to. Well, be your own gods then. Why? You don't have to be obedient to him. God told you not to. Well, who cares? Who's he? You will be as gods in this new order that I want to suggest to you. And having made that decision, ever since, humanity has been using that instinct that's within us to create, to establish, to do great things that God gave us, but using it for other thrones, other glories, even our own, building our own towers of Babel, not to the honor of the one who made us, but to the honor of other gods, other beings, other serpents, if you like, that want to corrupt us and control what we're to live for. And effectively, it means that we're really living for ourselves, turning in on ourselves. And the result of that is that work itself has been heavily affected, not only because it's standing on its head. It's people are working with the rock. We're not working to honor God, not working as an act of worship anymore, but as an act of idolatry. But also working with a sense of struggle, a sense of futility. Genesis chapter 3, God comes to the man and the woman and speaks to them strong words of rebuke, in fact, words of cursing in both of their particular spheres. That the man is told, by the sweat of your brow you'll till the earth. From now on, it will be a struggle for you. Work is going to be tough. It will be a labor. It will be a drudge. And that will be you'll know when it's like that, that it's your fault. It wasn't meant to be. It was meant to be a challenge, but it wasn't meant to be a destructive challenge that makes you feel kind of corrupted and sort of lacking in dignity. And he talks to the man one way, he talks to the woman and the other way. He particularly refers to her role as a mother and says, you know, by pain you will bring children into the earth. And so in different kind of spheres, in areas where they carry responsibility, each of them feels the pain of their sin as work becomes a distorted thing. And obviously we live in the reality of that. You live in a world where work has become characterized by two things. One, by a drivenness, which is really worship turned on its head, where we work, we give ourselves perhaps wholeheartedly, furiously, to work for a goal that is less than worship. It's not an honorable goal. We work for a career prospect that's ultimately for our own glory. We're living really to dazzle the world with how great we are, and the end is so that we can have our own sense of self-sufficiency. We made it. We achieved. We received the recognition of our peers. We've done something great. Now I know that I'm worth something because I worked so hard. I've become something great. That's the sort of drivenness I'm talking about. Now you can see how that's really turning the original plan that God had on its head, because Adam and Eve were not created to prove that they were worth something. They're made in God's image. They already carry this tremendous dignity anyway. And they're not to be driven. They're to live gladly in the good of God's favor always. Working hard, certainly, but with a tremendous sense of freedom, liberty, joy. Not drivenness. And the honor that they're working for was not to finally achieve a sense of worth. They already have that. And certainly not to glorify themselves and make themselves great, because only God is to be glorified and made great. So this drivenness that is a characteristic of the workplace in all of our lives, we see it around us, we see it within ourselves quite often, I'm sure, is a characteristic of sin. It's something that's crept into work, and it's the opposite of worship. But the other side of the coin, the other thing, is a sense of futility. Because even when we do achieve great things, we have to acknowledge the fact that the great things we've achieved seem somewhat meaningless. They won't be remembered in years to come. Certainly won't be remembered in centuries to come. They're things that will eventually fade against eternity. They're not eternally worth anything, really. In eternity, they're worth nothing, even the greatest achievements. So even our great efforts seem to yield little ultimately if we don't understand God, if we're disconnected from God. And even just generally, I often use the illustration of the program The Office, which is such a powerful example. It's a comedy, but it's quite sobering, because what it's saying about just the way that we work, and it's obviously particularly acute in a kind of post-industrial society and the service industries and so on, where people feel so alienated from any kind of productivity in their work. They sort of feel literally that they're pushing paper around. You know, The Office is a program about a place where people are using paperwork for a factory that makes paper. And it just seems so kind of detached from anything fruitful and authentic. But they're giving their time and energy, and the characters become more and more zombie-like. The people that have worked there longest are more and more sort of stupefied and have zero sense of dignity and sense of creativity. There's a little spark about them. And that's the essence for so many people of working life. It doesn't enhance their humanity. It diminishes it, stops them from being themselves because they're just absorbed into a life where it just seems futile. I'm not really contributing anything worthwhile. And life is futile, work is futile. And work is hard. It's really hard. Now, that's the result of the fall. That's the result of our sin. It should never have been that way. And obviously, you know the story. If you don't, this is the story. That God was not happy, content to leave it that way. God's plan has always been to restore, to redeem his creation, to bring back to fulfillment the project he began in creation. God wants to win everything back. Now, perhaps one of the most powerful passages of the Bible that reveals to us the scale of God's work of redemption is there in Colossians chapter 1, where it says that through Jesus Christ, God has reconciled all things to himself. All things. And the way it's described is quite emphatic. All things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible. There's an exhaustive scope to the plan of redemption, which must include the working environment, the life of work, the things that we do. When God sent his Son into the world, the intention he had was so much greater than the individual redemption of individual people from sin so that they could be rescued, so that one day in the dim and distant future everything will be all right again. And in the meantime we have to put up with just the hard labor of this world, which is a sad, shameful world, and a physical world which is not particularly glorifying to God anyway. You see, many people, even Christian, many Christians, in fact, have taken on this idea that's actually not a Bible idea. It's more of a kind of Greek idea that basically physical things are somehow lacking in spiritual worth. That what we call the natural world is not sacred. It's not spiritual. It's not really noble. And really what we're always aspiring to is the sort of spiritual ideal which is conceptual and free from the kind of trappings of concrete physical flesh. In the Greek philosophy of people like Plato, the human body even was seen as a bit of a hindrance to really being truly existing. And that what you ultimately wanted to do was shake off the hindrances of physicality, because being physical, being natural, was almost a bit evil. It was a shame. It's a sad thing. That's a Greek idea. But the frustrating thing is it's crept over history right into the church. So that actually those things which are physical, those things which seem temporal, earthy, practical, are sometimes seen in a fairly sort of bad light, and not really as a context for worship, not really as a context for knowing God. And if you want to be spiritual, you have to really try and to pull away from the world, and as much as possible abstain from the normality of life, so that you can really be spiritual. You know, you can exit the world. And there are obvious, very obvious examples through history of how that's been done. Monastic orders, which have been so kind of ruthless about it, that people would detach themselves. I mean, you know, the famous story of one of the early fathers in the desert who lived literally up a pole for years. And just kind of, you know, I don't know how he went through the practicalities and the bodily functions of life, but nevertheless, that was his way of trying to live a holy, spiritual life. And that's an extreme example, but there are various ways that's been done in other ways. People who detach themselves and say, no, we cannot engage with the culture because the culture is wicked, and we don't want to engage with the world. We don't really want to engage with our bodies that much because it's all so wicked and sinful. We really want to escape to be with the ethereal cloud who is God. And that's more Greek than Christian. You have to come to terms with it. It's not a Christian idea at all. The New Testament doesn't teach that. Even the word spiritual can be misunderstood in certain texts of the New Testament to mean something vague and ethereal, when actually it doesn't mean that. You see, Jesus rose from the dead as a physical being. We'll talk about this a bit more in a second. Jesus' resurrection, John's gospel deliberately specifies how things happened. They fed him fish after he rose from the dead. And after he'd eaten the fish was gone. He wasn't like, that was their way of knowing he's not a ghost. He's not just a spirit in that sense. Because if you give fish to a ghost, you get fish. That's it. And the way that the Bible puts it is deliberate. It's trying to say, look, Jesus is a physical man. Yes, he's a spiritual man, no mistake, a life-giving spirit. But that doesn't mean that he doesn't have this concrete identity. And even now in heaven, there is a man, Christ Jesus. That's how he's referred to in the New Testament. The man, Christ Jesus. He's the Son of God. He is God incarnate. But he's also physical, human. God wants you to feel the weight of that. And God's plan for the world is not just the restoration of everything away from physical matter, but actually the restoration of physical matter. God is going to create not just heaven, but a new heavens and a new earth to restore everything. So that our labor, even the gritty, hands-dirty labor that you and I get involved with, it needn't be seen as a detachment from spiritual worship. It's actually a practical context for it. So redemption in Christ is cosmic. It touches everything and not reduced to religious or spiritual, in that inverted commas spiritual sense, plane of existence. This affects the exhortations to work in the New Testament. There's a sacred dimension to it. Romans 12, after all that Paul has taught through the first 11 chapters of Romans, which is the big, grand explanation of God's plan through history, it comes straight into land in chapter 12 with some practical things. But the way he puts it is, he says, this is your reasonable act of worship. Offer yourselves, your bodies as living sacrifices, your bodies. Offer the things that you do, the work that you do, offer it as an act of worship, real worship to God. He's using temple language. That's what the scholars say. It's like he's using the language of the priesthood. But the priests that we're talking about now are not those that dwell in a particular building, a temple made of stone, offering animals on a sacrificial altar, but us offering our lives daily as an act of worship, just as Adam and Eve were intended to in the first place. This has huge, huge ramifications for us. Good practical examples I can think of. People like my friend Stephen Dawson, who is actually on the staff of this church now, but years ago was a volunteer staff member of the church. And then after that went into gardening and ran a gardening business with his brother. And I'm always struck by the comment that he made. Now, he's a very gifted leader in the church and clearly called to leadership in the church, and I suspect that will mark the rest of his life in some way. But for a very specific season, God clearly called him into running this business with his brother. And the temptation for someone who's been through that stage of life is to think, well, look, I did the spiritual time when I was doing the volunteer work for the church, but now I'm just a gardener. So now I'm not doing a spiritual job. I'm not doing a Christian job. I'm just doing a gardening, dog's body kind of job. But I remember him saying to me really powerfully, said that I don't know of anything better than having someone say to me at the end of a job we've done for them on their garden, saying, that is a superb piece of work. Thank you. He said that gives me genuine joy, a sense of, we've actually served God with this. And I found that staggering because it was such a good, mature example of someone who's got this right. And what also struck me was the fact that it was literally gardening. You think, well, gardening isn't a very spiritual job. You think, well, actually, it's kind of the first job that a man ever got given, and pretty spiritual. pretty spiritual. You get your hands literally very muddy, very dirty, but you're being spiritual in that context. And that's just one example of it. But the Bible, the New Testament, is full of these kinds of exhortations. The Colossians chapter 3, let me just read this out. This goes out to slaves, which is hardly a grand, noble profession. Obey in everything those who are your earthly masters, not by way of eye service, as people pleases. So, yeah, work hard, but not to climb the tree. Work hard, not to be popular with your masters. That's not really the point. But with sincerity of heart, fearing the Lord. He's your master. Even as a slave, you get to worship God in your work, fearing God. Whatever you do, work heartily as for the Lord, and not for men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the inheritance as your reward. You are serving the Lord Christ, for the wrongdoer will be paid back for the wrong he's done, and there is no partiality. I remember a story of a Chinese doctor, fairly high-up medic, who was in trouble for her faith as a Christian, and was brought, really, it's a totalitarian regime. You're in certain parts of China, the persecution of Christians is pretty fierce. And she was taken away from her medical world, not allowed to be a doctor anymore because of her Christian faith, and basically made to be a loo cleaner. That's what she had to become. So from that time onwards, in spite of all her training, her hard work, and her status as a doctor, all that she'd known, she was now cleaning loos as a Christian. And people said to her, how do you cope? What do you, how do you do it? It's so demeaning. How do you do your job? And she said, well, it's easy. It's simple. I just carry on doing it I do it very seriously. I clean every loo as if Jesus was going to use it next. And, when I first heard that, I thought, okay, interesting phrase. It kind of jolted me. I thought, what? That's a strange idea. Because we don't imagine that Jesus ever used the loo. Because he couldn't have done it. He just kind of glided through life. He was actually a ghost. No, that's just where we got it so wrong. We're wrong. The Bible would never teach us to think that way. Actually, what she was doing was serving God in that context, because she knew, I'm serving Christ. Even if evil Chinese dictators put me in prison for doing stuff, I can find I'm going to serve God, even in the most apparently demeaning and degrading of circumstances, because it is worthwhile. It's offered to God. Another helpful way of explaining this is the chapter of 1 Corinthians, which deals with the resurrection. One of the longest chapters in the New Testament, a great long chapter where Paul is describing in detail the meaning of Jesus' resurrection and the fact that it happened and the implications it has. Right at the end of the chapter, though, he makes this interesting statement. He says, in verse 58, he says, therefore, brothers, therefore, press on. In fact, has anyone got 1 Corinthians 15 open? I'm up here without my Bible. I'm using my PC. Let me find it, and then we can actually, thank you. I will use this and actually read it to get the precise words. The exhortation right at the end of this chapter, which deals with the resurrection, is often seen as a verse on its own. People write it, put it on their fridge, and it's all kind of very inspiring. But if you don't actually see it in the context of a big chapter about Jesus having risen from the dead, you can miss the really big point that's being made. Therefore, my beloved brethren, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that your toil is not in vain in the Lord. The fact that Jesus rose from the dead in the New Testament is presented as proof that God will raise everything from the dead. Jesus is the first fruit. Jesus is God's first step in resurrection. God's plan is to restore creation, to bring about a new heavens and a new earth, just as he brought about a new body for his son. He's the first. He is the beginning, the firstborn from amongst the dead, Colossians chapter 1 again. If that's so, it means that those things that we do to serve God, be they ever so demeaning, even if it's cleaning loos in a prison in China, or if it's presenting masterpieces for the wall of some museum, or if it's teaching bottom set year eights the glories of the cottage industries in the 18th century. Those things that look apparently so demeaning, if offered to God as an act of worship, are not in vain. And they're not in vain in the same sense that Jesus' obedience to the Father was not in vain. It was resurrected. I get from that the strange idea that I can't completely understand and probably not supposed to understand, that in eternity, you've got to hear that this is, honestly, if you get this in your heart, this is more powerful for your work life than anything I can think of. In eternity, in some way that we don't totally grasp, those acts of service to God will somehow prevail, will last, will come through the flames, if you like. Not just your church work, not just the witnessing, the praying, the Bible reading, not just the kindness to others in the street, not just the service to the poor, all of those things being vital, but the very, very apparently mundane acts of work, as we do them as acts of worship to God, we're actually creating things that are not in vain. In other words, they're not going to wither. The word vanity means it's a vapor, it doesn't last. No, we're talking about things that will last. Somehow. I don't know how. I haven't got a clue how it could be that, you know, marking exercise books and putting big red marks under the bad spelling again of that word, that you keep telling them how it's spelled. That seems just so, you know, mundane. But no, in some way, these things are adorned in eternity. You know, maybe everything in eternity, your books will come back to you all spelt perfectly. You know, all the bad spelling will be rubbed out, and you'll have this thing that, I don't know, but there's ways in which God will honor our work as acts of worship to him, which are given as service to glorify God. So all our working is within the scope of redemption. Even the most apparently cursed, we're delivered from futility, from indignity. We're delivered from idolatry. It's done with the ultimate dependence on God's enabling grace, which obviously means that we do need to do it for God's glory. It means that we have to cut ourselves off from a drivenness that is fleshly, that is wrong. There is a kind of fleshliness that is ignoble. It's not the fact that it's work, it's the fact that it's working for us. That's wrong. Working for our own honor, for our own glory, forgetting to see it as an act of worship to God where he gets the honor. That's wrong. But when we do it for God's honor, well, we know that we're doing it for God's honor because we're aware of his grace in it. We're aware of his help. We're saying, God, I can't do this without your help. We're conscious of that every day as we drive into the car park. Every day as we unpack our bags ready for another, as we stick stuff on the blackboard or whatever it is that you have these days, whiteboards, computer, technicolor screens with 3D images. I don't know what it is. I've been out of teaching for too long. But the way that we prepare ourselves, we do it dependent. God, grace. If I don't have grace, I'll be doing this for all the wrong reasons. I'll be doing it for my own glory and honor. So those are some key things about vocation that we need to hold firm to. A little bit briefer then, let's look at worldview. And Brian will talk to us after the break, and some of these things will probably come out of other features of the day as we go on. But let me just touch on this theme of worldview, which I alluded to earlier. The reality is, everybody does have a worldview. A worldview is really a kind of set of lenses through which we see the world, through which we see everything. And everyone has one, not everyone has the right one. What we have to accept if we trust that God is there, that he's true, that he cares about truth, is that there is a right worldview. There is a worldview that is the right one, the biblical one, the one that the Bible teaches. And a quotation from George Barna, you should have in your notes. Without a biblical worldview, all the great teaching goes in one ear and out the other. There are no intellectual pegs in the mind of the individual to hang these truths on, so they just pass through. They don't stick. They don't make a difference. The teaching we are receiving from the Bible, from preaching, from teaching, from Bible study on our own, just from reading our Bibles, reading good Christian books, is intended to build within us a framework of understanding through which we filter everything. One of the frustrations for those who do preach and teach in the church is the sense we sometimes get that some people hear teaching as atomized pieces of information that are helpful for that week, but then go out of their minds for the rest of their lives. And that, I don't know why that happens, but it does happen. I get the sense that some people, you can teach them one thing one Sunday, and they appreciate it very much. You can get up on the following Sunday and teach the precise opposite, the direct opposite. In every sense, conceptually, completely the opposite of what you said the week before. And the same person might come back and say, that was amazing, that was wonderful, I really appreciated it. And I don't do that. I might do it just for fun, see what happens. But I'm kind of getting at something. Like people who you think, is the teaching bedding down? Is it creating in your mind a conscious system where you know, okay, that's true, and therefore that can't be? And because this is true, this also is true, and so we'll bring that in. And because these things are true, that can't be true. So we reject that, and we accept that, and we draw that in, filtering things according to the authority of the Bible, which has to be the final authority, because that was Jesus' final authority. In every argument he ever had, he always came back to that axiom, it is written. Jesus was happy, satisfied. If it was written, it was true in the scriptures, not just written on a postcard or in the yellow pages. Written in the Bible, that was enough for Jesus. It was his final authority, and so it should be ours. Everyone has a worldview. How do our worldviews affect us? Well, let me just use this quotation from James Sire to define it. A worldview is a set of presuppositions, assumptions, which may be true, partially true or entirely false, which we hold consciously or subconsciously, consistently or inconsistently, about the basic makeup of the world. Everybody has these. Everybody presupposes things. Everybody bases their arguments on certain presuppositions. Nobody doesn't do this. Even scientists who say it is provable that X equals Y, and therefore this must happen, are still basing that on certain assumptions about logic, certain presuppositions that can't be defeated in their own mind. You say, why can't they? And they say, well, it's obvious, isn't it? And you say, well, it might not be obvious to someone else. It might not be. So we each of us bring presuppositions to the table that may be more flawed than we realize. Presuppositions about good and bad, true and false, polite and impolite, punctual and impunctual. Each one of us comes with tremendous amounts of presuppositional baggage, and we need to question it in the light of the Bible worldview to make sure that we're lining up with truth as the Bible teaches it. All of us have an intellectual infrastructure upon which we base our life views and ideas, even if it's not consciously constructed. These are the kind of questions that a worldview might actually answer. What is prime reality, the really real? Okay, what's really real? Is this all real, or is it just like a big Truman show? Where actually I am not... all of you are pretending to be my friends right now. Have you seen the Truman Show? You know, that amazing movie is so clever. Perfect example of a worldview that is constructed for someone, but it's not real. This guy spends his whole life thinking that the world is real. Actually, he is a whole TV show that's about his life, a reality show. What is real? What is the nature of external reality, that is, the world around us? What is a human being? What happens to a person at death? Why is it possible to know anything at all? How do we know what is right and wrong? What is the meaning of human history? Now, I say this because you need to be equipped with a biblical worldview. I also say it because the world is not equipped with a biblical worldview. The world has decided against a biblical worldview. And especially in the Western liberal world of education in the UK, the biblical worldview is seen as totally anachronistic. In other words, it doesn't belong. Biblical worldview is unwelcome. We don't want the biblical worldview in the minds of our children. We resist it. We do not, it does not belong here in our schools. And so even national curriculum manifests a worldview. The way that we're taught and the things that we're asked to teach, the things that have to be taught in schools, and the way in which they're taught reflect. It's not objective, it's not neutral. It reflects a system of belief. It reflects a worldview, some presuppositions on what's true and what's not. There are tremendous assumptions that are made about it. There is a worldview, normally a kind of secular, liberal, usually what I'd call egalitarian worldview, where everything is kind of brought down to lowest common denominator. And the passion for equality means that no one is allowed to be different, no one is allowed to be right or wrong or more virtuous or less virtuous. And this prevailing worldview means that in every aspect of education, not just in RE, ideas and principles that are held too religiously are being put across. Now, we have to come to terms with that. This may be, for some of us, the biggest... paradigm shift that we face during this training day, that we have to just come to the fact, actually, when you think about it, everything that's being taught in my school does come from some kind of worldview, and most of it will not be coming from a Christian worldview, most of it. It's not to say that everything that's taught is evil. Often those things which are taught from a non-Christian background will actually chime in with a Christian worldview. Most teachers, for example, most curricula will not, for example, teach that racism is right. In fact, that would be a passionate, you know, a concern of most in education, that they would deliberately want to instruct children against racial prejudice. Now, that's perfectly fitting with a biblical worldview. A Christian school, if such a thing were to exist, would want to teach exactly the same thing. A Christian teacher, a biblical teacher, wants to teach precisely the same thing, but for a totally different reason. Racism isn't wrong just because it's wrong. See, that's the idea that's behind so much of modern education. Prejudice, discrimination is wrong because it's wrong. But that isn't good enough. The Bible teaches much more about why it's wrong. The Bible teaches something about humanity, made in God's image, in every place in humanity, every ethnic group, which will give us foundations, a worldview, a presupposition, which helps us to think through all of these huge questions of rightness, wrongness, truth, falsehood. I suppose a good example might be history. My subject was history. Most of you would have worked that out. I was a teacher of history, and something that I've only really, you know, I've come to terms with over the years is that the way that you see history will be hugely different if you believe the Bible than someone who doesn't. Absolutely enormous difference. Partly because most of, through recent years in the West, the idea of history is the idea of general progress, that humanity is becoming more and more advanced, more and more civilized, more and more tolerant, more and more educated, more and more clean, and various kinds of strengths and liberalities and freedoms have come in as history's got going. People have generally improved, become more liberal, and we don't believe in certain things we believed in the past because, well, that was the past, and we've made progress since then. Those were evil things in the past because it was the past, the idea of progress. Well, that's not what the Bible teaches. In fact, the Bible almost teaches the opposite, that we've fallen from what we were. We've fallen from the good that we once were. And so you have to think, well, actually, so much of what's taught, you realize if you're teaching on the abolition of slavery, for example, the way it could come across through many textbooks and many things, materials that teachers are given to teach it, is that really this was a result of the Western civilization becoming more and more humanitarian and tolerant and lacking in discrimination because we were more educated, we were more enlightened, we were less restricted by things like superstition and religion. So we got rid of the slave trade. That's actually basically false. That's not what really happened. A huge reason, one of the main, perhaps the main reason why the slave trade was abolished was because Christians with a Christian conscience and a biblical worldview opposed it, took it on, beat it in the House of Commons. Very different from saying, well, it's just general progress as we got more liberal and less spooky and religious. But that's the concept of history that many will have received. And so it affects the way we'll think about history. That's just one example. I mean, in your different subjects, you'll need to think through the impact of this. But the need is for us to equip saints with a biblical worldview so that believers don't end up supporting the wrong things by accident. So that we don't just think, well, I'm a Christian teacher, which means that I'm nice to my pupils and I tell my friends, I read a Bible during break time. That's why I'm a Christian teacher. Please do read a Bible at break time. Please be nice to your pupils. But please don't forget that this will affect the way you interpret and filter even those things that you're called on to teach and how to teach them. So there are huge things that we could look at. Now, I'm not going to go through all these notes because of time, but I've touched on here, broad brush on how a biblical worldview affects our teaching. It will affect our teaching because of the idea of creation. A biblical worldview on creation means that God's plan is to bring about order over against chaos, a stewarding of the earth, an investigation and development of resources for the sake of God's glory. That's going to have implications on the way that we teach and the way even that we run a school. That, yeah, we believe in order over chaos, not just because it's expedient, not because it's better than kids going around stabbing each other, just, you know, it just seems a little bit more preferential. You know, it's functional to do it that way. It's functional to have order in a classroom because generally lessons go a bit better if it's less anarchic. No, we believe in order because God believes in order. God believes in stewarding responsibly his creation. What does the Bible teach about children themselves? Are they just binary objects? Are they just sort of evolutions of organic matter that have kind of developed by accident from primeval stuff? Or are they people made in God's image, and therefore those to whom we have an enormous responsibility? What does the Bible teach us about the value, the dignity of children? What does the Bible teach us about the sinfulness of children as well? The way that we understand things like discipline, the way we understand things like rebuking, it's going to be hugely different from the way the world sees it. See, the book of Proverbs says that foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child. That is the exact opposite of what someone like Jean-Jacques Rousseau in the 18th century taught. That basically, that what is needed is for children to be totally freed up from the chains of culture, and really building on the shoulders of Rousseau's work. Educational theorists ever since, particularly people like John Dewey, the American philosopher, have run riot with the idea that really the less you try and prevail upon the will of a child, the less you try and discipline the child, the less you try and see him or her as a moral agent and actually see the person, that morality is not the issue, but they just need to be freed up to express themselves and all that's within them, the better for the child. The last thing we want to do is impose discipline. The last thing we want to do is even impose our ideas and indoctrinate. That's a terrible thing. My friends, that's actually right there in the heart of most education theory. You need to know that. But it's wrong. The Bible does teach that children actually do need instruction. They even need discipline. They even need counsel that says, no, this is false, this is bad, you should not do this. And to only go along the lines of thinking, well, basically they are cherubs who have nothing wrong with them except us bad teachers coming along and spoiling all their fun, that's just an unbiblical worldview. And I think instinctively we all know this. I think that's why teachers find themselves so confused and struggle, thinking, how can I impose discipline? I feel so bad when I try to be disciplinary. I feel so bad being strict. Christian teachers even. I've heard a lot of Christian teachers having terrible qualms of conscience because they occasionally get strict. And they think, well, it's not very Christian, is it? Not being very Christian by being strict. Because they've swallowed the Western myth that strictness is to assault the child's liberties. And they've actually imagined that that's a Christian idea, because they've got a sentimental idea of Christianity as basically niceness. That's not Christianity, that's bubblegum. It's not the Bible. The Bible still teaches that children do need discipline. They do need to be told right and wrong, sometimes quite strongly, because it's for their good, it's for their protection. Desperately needed. You read the book of Proverbs, it's an interesting book. Very forthright about how what children need. You can save them from destruction with discipline. With clarity, with clear boundary lines, and even imposing discipline in terms of, you know, forfeits on their time, and actually using some degree of authority in their lives. I find that this needs emphasizing, because as I say, I think we can mistake a genuine tender care for children with a mushiness that doesn't actually impose authority. I do believe that's unbiblical, and we just have to be discerning in this. I guess perhaps an illustration of this was when I was training to teach. I was given the opportunity to train in a school in North Tyneside, in one of the roughest parts of Britain. It was, I mean, I could spend a while describing how bad it was as an area. And one example would be that many of the streets surrounding the school, where the children walked in from the school, you would see that the windows were boarded up, but the children still lived there. If you open the door, there was no staircase, because families would what you would call a family, I hardly don't know if you'd call it a family even, but would sell the staircase as firewood to pay for their drug habit. So there were riots in 1992, significant looting going on in the area, in the North Tyneside area, in this part of North Tyneside. To the point where I think one man was on television vouching for his son, saying he's been taken by the police, but he's not a vandal, he's not a looter, he is a professional ram raider. And that was his defense for his son. You know, it was, how dare you lock him up? He's a pro. You know. So that's the kind of moral ethos that prevailed in the streets of this area. In the middle of it, there was the school that I was sent to train in. Yeah. And I thought, oh, my word. When I told people the place I was going to, they all kind of just looked away and said, I'm so sorry, Joel. I'm so sorry. It was lovely knowing you. We'll see you in heaven. That was the kind of thing I got from my Christian friends who said, this was the thing. The school itself, especially certain departments within it, was astonishing. The kind of results they were getting national attention in the press. It got written about in the Observer newspaper. On the value-added evaluation, it was the eighth highest in the country. So it was an incredible privilege to actually be there, because with the most unlikely children, most unlikely circumstances, the kind of atmosphere, the ethos of work, the ethos of excellence, the ethos of wanting children to do well and seeing them do well and seeing children from those kinds of backgrounds coming away with something on paper that says, I can do stuff. I can actually learn. I've got the capacity to learn and read and remember and pass exams, sometimes very well. It was remarkable. I just thought this was an astonishing result. What I found, though, when I got close to the sausage factory and thought, you know, how does it actually work, was very surprising to me, because it kind of went against some of the things that I was learning in the educational theory lectures I was getting at the university. Because much of the teaching was rather old-fashioned. Much of the teaching was a little bit more didactic and certainly slightly more front-led than I was taught to expect. I was taught that those things were out of date and wrong. I was also taught that you shouldn't really expect classroom management to be done strictly, or if you want it to be done well, it should never be very strict. Classroom management in the school was pretty strict, pretty firm. And children who went out of line knew about it quite quickly, and so did the rest of the class normally. But what the result of that was that the level of excellence, the level of the standard of disciplined behavior that was high, and children wanted to aspire to it. I was inspired by that to the point where I realized that was how I needed to learn to teach. When I went on to my first paid job, it was in a much nicer area and it had all the kind of raw materials for expecting it to be quite idyllic. Children from fairly nice middle class rural area, which you'd expect, you know, it'd all be very pleasant. The standard of discipline and the level of expectation was shockingly low. And the way that the children behaved was so appalling compared to this apparently very rough school. And I couldn't help feeling all the time, putting two and two together, it's not so much necessarily about the background of the kids, it's about what teachers expect from kids. It's so much to do with what we believe children are capable of doing and what we'll call them to if we believe that, yeah, discipline works, that there is right, there is wrong, there is truth, there is falsehood. Now, that's just, I could go on and on about that and often do, but I don't have time. So I'm just mentioning that as one example of how a biblical worldview will affect the way we see children. It'll affect the way we see wisdom, that we won't necessarily think in terms of child-centered ideas, but think in terms of truth-centered ideas, that we have a responsibility to pass wisdom on to the next generation. The results of the fall, I've talked about Rousseau and his idea of humanity. Interestingly, Jean-Jacques Rousseau himself, French philosopher, who said children were you know, needed to be freed up from the pain of culture and were delightful cherubs, he hated children. He had loads of illegitimate kids and he didn't like any of them. So it's interesting about to see the hypocrisies of intellectual ideas. The existence of moral absolutes versus therapeutic categories, that children need to be taught about right, wrong, truth. I've emphasized that already. Disciplined philosophy will emerge differently. Again, I've touched on this just now. And I could give, again, many, many examples of the same kind of principle. Let me say one thing finally to you, just to close this session before we break. I know I'm going slightly over time. We'll perhaps let the break be just 5 minutes over. Is that right, Brian? We do that. Let me just say one last thing. I want to encourage you guys as teachers. I really want to ask you to keep seeing yourself as those who are on the front line of mission because of the things I've been saying. Because you carry a God-given vocation to honor him in the workplace, but also to advance a biblical worldview. To find ways, graciously, subtly, humbly, not obstinately, not ruthlessly, not harshly, but in a way that incarnates, that you get right into the world of your school, you listen, you learn, you watch carefully to understand the different worldviews that are presented to you. But by holding to a biblical worldview and serving God with that, you may find that you are far more influential in the shaping of the culture, much more than you even realize. Maybe much more than some of the people in the church who you might think of as highly influential. Because you're actually, in the context of the chalk face or the coal face, serving God and pushing back the lines of darkness. I came across recently a quotation from a great theologian called Gresham Machen, who put it like this, and this is just a helpful quotation that I'll close on. It says this: "False ideas are the greatest obstacle to the reception of the gospel. We may preach with all the fervor of a reformer and yet succeed only in winning a struggler here or there if we permit the whole collective thought of a nation to be controlled by ideas which prevent Christianity from being regarded as no more than a harmless delusion." Someone like me gets up and preaches on a Sunday, or anyone who gets up and preaches in a public place, the pure, simple gospel of Jesus. What this man is saying is that the more the Christian message has got into the community as salt, the more it's pressed itself in through teachers, through whoever, actually the more fruitful our evangelism is going to be anyway, because more people have a grid for understanding the claims of the Bible. What we might call pre-evangelism is taking place, as those who aren't conventional evangelists are actually doing an important work, getting out there with the truth of the gospel where it counts, and it gives an opportunity for the gospel to take some form when it beds down in people's minds who otherwise would never understand it. Does that make sense? We have a huge role to play in helping people shift their worldview to be more conscious of God and therefore more receptive to the gospel. Let's just pray together and then we'll have a break. God, thank you for this time again. And I pray particularly for us to keep thinking carefully through these issues of worldview and our own calling as those who serve you in the context of the workplace. Lord, help us to be very fruitful in these things for your glory. In Jesus' name, amen.